Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to tonight's program of the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from the historic Fairmont Hotel here in San Francisco. I'm Skip Rhodes, president of the Commonwealth Club, and your chair this evening. We are pleased to co-sponsor tonight's program with Stacy's Bookstore. We also welcome the listeners of WBEZ Chicago, one of the more than 220 radio stations nationwide carrying America's longest-running radio program. We invite all of our listeners to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org for information about our organization, transcripts of recent speeches, and online discussions. And now for tonight's program. Tonight, we are pleased to have Gore Vidal in conversation with Wendy Lesser. Wendy is the editor of the Three Penny Review, the Berkeley literary magazine. Her most recent book is the author of an excellent memoir, The Amateur, An Independent Life of Letters. Please welcome Wendy Lesser. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce one of America's most highly regarded authors and political activists. When Gore Vidal ran for Congress in New York in 1960, he said, and I quote, "I say 80% of what I think, a hell of a lot more than any politician I know." Gore Vidal has shared so many of his thoughts with us in the past half century that I doubt that he is holding back that other 20% any longer. In 24 novels, more than 200 essays, 5 plays, 1 book of short stories, and 1 memoir, he has told us more about America than any of our full-time politicians could ever hope to achieve. His works have always managed that difficult task of saying something important and still saying it well. He is not, of course, easy to pigeonhole. As one critic has written, Vidal is, quote, "a living dialectical synthesis, a populist patrician, a ruthless critic of politics who ran for public office, a patriot who is an expatriate, and a mocker of pop culture who spends a lot of time in Hollywood." The grandson of T.P. Gore, senator from Oklahoma, Mr. Vidal has always been in politics and ran in the Democratic primary for the U.S. Senate in 1982 from California, finishing second in a field of 9. In fact, Vice President Albert Gore is his distant cousin. Talking to reporters during the Democratic convention in Los Angeles this summer, Mr. Vidal said, "I do believe they are nominating the wrong Gore." Please. His works have been widely appreciated, both by the public and by the critics, from The City and The Pillar to Myra Breckinridge to the American Chronicle series that includes Burr, Lincoln, 1876, Empire, Hollywood, and Washington, D.C. His 1959 play, The Best Man, which is about the days leading up to a national political convention, is in revival on Broadway and is receiving strong reviews. We are here tonight on the occasion of the publication of the latest of Mr. Vidal's historical novels. The new novel, entitled The Golden Age, is a vivid portrayal of American political and cultural life from 1939 to 1954, when the events of World War II and the Cold War transformed America, once and for all, in Vidal's view, from a republic to an empire. Please join me in giving a rousing Commonwealth Club welcome to Mr. Gore Vidal. Mr. Vidal. Thank you.
my legs are not what they were.
Luckily, the rest of him is, so the evening will be fine.
The evening is not over.
I will want to ask you a great deal about the new novel, which I see is piled in healthy numbers in the back of the room there. But first, I do want to ask the question that I'm sure everybody in the audience wants to know the answer to, which is, did you watch the debates last night, and what did you think?
Well, right afterwards, I was on something called Politically Incorrect with Mr. Mayer. And, well, it wasn't Lincoln Douglas. They're so over-rehearsed now. At least, I love this, your distant cousin. I mean, this is now one word. It is true, I've seen to it that we have never met, but I knew his father quite well, and we are not distant cousins. We're both brought up in Washington. And with a third cousin called Grady Gore, who owned the Fairfax Hotel, where Albert spent his youth. Recently, I was asked, most of my friends are going to vote for Ralph Nader, and they have approached me. And I said, well, at the end of the day, as the Republican managers of the House of Representatives used to say during the impeachment, at the end of the day, Gore is thicker than Nader. I will vote for the family. There is an old saying in Mississippi that if a snake bites a Gore, they all puff up.
I thought he actually seemed remarkably humanoid last night compared to other appearances. I mean, he was working on voice modulation and things like that.
I don't know why he's had this trouble, because he's very bright, and he's certainly... somebody asked last night, you know, how do I rate them as actors? Because it is well known that in 1959, I turned down for a lead in The Best Man, Ronald Reagan.
which part?
The lead, on the grounds that he would not be credible as a presidential candidate. Melvin Douglas then took the part and went on to glory and a great career, and Henry Fonda did it in the movies. And poor Ron had to go back to become governor of California. Didn't seem to be in the cards then. So I said, as actors, you know, which is better, Gore or Bush? And I said, oh, come on. I used to hang out at the Actors Studio. Bush is much better. I mean, to play that dumb is hard. You have to see your own dialogue in your head upside down to be able to do that. This is something, you know, any fool can play tragedy, but to play comedy, you have to be a genius like Chaplin or W last night.
He actually seemed to be shrinking in the course of the debate, didn't you think?
I was. I was not puffing up, anyway.
Now, on the subject of acting, I'm going to finally get to see The Best Man when I get to New York in November, but I haven't seen it yet. I've only heard reports. Are you pleased with this production?
Oh, it's very good. I think it's rather better than the first one. We have Spalding Gray in the Ronald Reagan part. And Chris Noth in the Cliff Robertson part. Charles Durning in Lee Tracy's part. It's a wonderful cast. It's good ensemble playing, as they say. And to my delight, but also a degree of sadness, it's very popular. And it's very popular because nothing has changed since 1960. It's exactly the way it was when it opened in March of 1960. 40 years later, that we have the same political types around makes a monkey of Darwin. There has been no evolving going on. But
maybe
it's nice for me and it's nice for the audience, as they laugh quite a bit. though it's not a comedy, I think it's... But you must express relief somehow.
I gather that one of the characters has a line to the effect, I'm going to misquote this because I can't remember the humorous version of it, but to the effect that Americans have no irony. But that can't be true because you're American and you're filled with irony.
Oh, yes.
I mean, did you actually give a character the line that Americans have no irony?
No.
So somebody went to the theater and heard that and you didn't say it?
No, I never said it.
That's amazing.
And it's not in the play, but I'm used to that.
Huh.
I'm told there's a site on the internet, which I never visit, but of my collected sayings. Well, some of them are just, you know, I've never heard before. At a certain point, you get... I remember Dorothy Parker used to say that... I said, have you really said all those wonderful things? She said, no. I take credit for them, but I don't say them. I wouldn't dare.
If we could talk about the Golden Age for just a short time, and then probably the audience will have some questions about it, but I, of course, being a literary magazine editor, was interested that you had put in it a magazine. And I was wondering if the American idea was based on a real magazine or a magazine you wish had existed in the early 40s but didn't. I mean, where did you get the idea of giving that magazine to one of your main characters?
Well, it seems like a logical thing for him to do. I had a brother-in-law whose father started the New Republic, now known as the New Repulsive. And unfortunately, he sold it to another management. It would be, for somebody interested in politics who was not going to be in politics, a kind of thing to do. It was in Washington, D.C., which has many of the same characters as the Golden Age. But where in the Golden Age I was focused on the fictional people, in this I'm focused on President and Mrs. Roosevelt, Harry Hopkins, Harry Truman, Dean Acheson. It's the years 1940 to 1950 when first we got the empire at the end of the Second World War, and then Truman militarized the economy for a number of reasons, some good, some bad. One was fear that we'd fall back into the Depression, which had resumed more terribly than before in 1938 and 9. 1940, when I began, Roosevelt had started to rearm. I think it was $7 billion he put into the economy for weapons, and there was no unemployment, proving Maynard Keynes was right. Why nobody had done that before without a war, I don't know. That's looking into the crystal ball of the past.
And in terms of looking into the crystal ball of the past, the novel ends, although it does take place in the middle of the century, it ends in the year 2000. You've included this wonderful last chapter in which you, in person, meet your alter ego character. What gave you the idea of doing that?
Well, I thought it'd be a kind of flashy sign-off. And so I meet the protagonist who founded the American idea.
Yeah.
And I also bring back, I go into kind of what is the theory of history? Is it real? Is it not real? What is fiction? And I suddenly bring in a young TV producer, director, who was filming us in Ravello. And I say out of the blue, the character that has my name says, you're Aaron Burr, aren't you? And he says, well, if you say I am. And I said, what are you going to do this time? Well, he said, I'm not going to go into politics. Well, what are you going to do? I always said something far bigger. I said, well, the internet? He said, no, bigger than that. This is the ambition of Aaron Burr, and that is one of the things I've been studying, is presidential ambition, what it is that drives people to devote their lives to trying to find the right earth colors to wear. And this is a great burden. And to want to do this is even more mysterious, but I think by the time you get through the seven volumes, you have an idea of what our leaders have been like, and the fact that they've mostly been dedicated to expansion, to creating wars with other people in order to acquire territory and importance. So that pattern is clear in it. And as W would say, and what was the question?
That's all right. You answered it.
I thought that was very sweet. You know? At least he didn't say, what was the answer to the wings?
Just to sidestep to another political campaign, what do you think of Hillary's chances or her campaign?
Well, I like her, and I think she's overqualified to be a senator from New York. Moynihan was very, very intelligent and made good speeches on every subject, but it was very careful to do nothing. Amato did quite a lot and set the tone, I think, for her position. I suspect she'll be elected. I suspect probably she would like to be president, but I don't see... She doesn't like the press, and who does, but she really doesn't like it. My advice, which was not sought, was she should go to Illinois and become governor. And governors are treated like presidents, and they're surrounded by guards. This poor woman, if she goes to the Senate, there's going to be somebody sitting outside of her office. And they can track you down if you're in the Senate. When do you feel about abortion in the third trimester? Imagine answering that every single day of your life. Sooner or later, you will snap. And there goes the White House.
And how did you choose Illinois as the appropriate state for her?
It's where she's from, dear.
But that doesn't seem to be her requirement.
You can go home again.
I'm going to give you alternating their questions and my questions to play fair, even though I have so many. I'll intersperse. So here's one from the audience. You've said the internet has resulted in the creation of flat prose. What impact do you believe the internet and the dot-com millionaires have had on the moral fiber of American society?
I've been looking for that moral fiber for half a century. Only found just sort of fat, you know. We're not very strong on moral fiber. It's a different kind of society. It's a consumer society. With a huge war machine, which is what they should be talking about in the debates. Both of them are in favor of increasing the Pentagon budget. Now, the Pentagon, as we speak, is getting 51% of the revenues of the country. They now want 30, the chiefs of the services have given an ultimatum. They want $30 billion a year more over the next decade. This is dangerous. You're not going to have any money for education. You're not going to have any money for anything. And there is no surplus, by the way. They claimed in 99 we have this magical surplus. Well, an accountant working on it. It's a $60 billion deficit, our usual homely red ink. So this is all just magic time. None of it's true. There's not going to be $1 trillion in the next decade. I love W and Cousin Albert going on as though this pie in the sky existed. It's just debt. And possibly inflation and the price of oil. There are many troubling things. But if I were in a position, I would certainly cut the Pentagon budget by 50%. You know, ever since the Soviet Union so unsportingly folded... in order to pursue proto-capitalism and double-entry bookkeeping. We had, at the time they collapsed, something like 2,200 missiles aimed at them. We now have, here we are 10 years later, we have 3,000 nuclear missiles aimed at them, China, and such great dangers to the United States as Iraq and Iran. It's worse. And yet the president keeps talking about, oh, we must make the world safe. I would just cut that budget. And I think a president who could explain it, or a candidate who could explain it and show that we don't need to pay as much tax as we do if the Pentagon was not taking so much money out of the federal budget. I love going on about Social Security last night. I mean,
that's when I started to cook dinner.
Yeah. That's when I started to eat it. tons of crow was coming my way. Social Security is a trust fund, and it's not federal revenue at all. It had a surplus. The federal government didn't, but Social Security had $150 billion in 99. Every bad guy in the country wants to get his hands on that money and put it in the market and, boy, invest it in IBM. I mean, they want to get hold of it. So privatize is the magic word. Whenever you hear that, a thief is on the scene.
The audience member's question about technology and moral fiber reminded me that I had meant to ask you about Henry Adams, because I just reread The Education, and I always think of you when I hear about Henry Adams or read Henry Adams, you being his 20th century alter ego in some way. And I wonder, have you reread The Education recently? It's incredible to read it in 2000, because 1900 is such a date in the book. It's amazing to go through a turn of a century with him and feel that how present he is still.
Well, he was a fascinating character, and of course I read him all the time. And one of our greatest historians, his study in, I think, six volumes of the administrations of Adams, Jefferson, Madison. It's marvelous, but what fascinated me about him, and I bring him sort of into the book,
As a ghost.
His idea of energy. But he said, somebody asked him why he quit writing history. He said, I was never interested in what happened. I wanted to know why it happened. Couldn't find out, quit. Well, I'm more interested in what happened because it is generally so distorted by what we call court historians, those who make the icon dusters who transform Lincoln and all our great men into something that they were not, in order that we be found always right, that we've never made a bad move in any way, and no great man is. I got a lot of flack years ago. I was one of the first people to go in a big public way in Burr since 1973, and the fact that Thomas Jefferson had several children by his slave, Sally Hemings. More to the point, which makes it even stranger, Sally Hemings' father was the father-in-law of Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson had been married to a white woman who was her half-sister. Aaron Burr made a trip, this is all true history, to Monticello and was quite struck by all these sort of red-headed boys and girls running around who looked just like the master and were slaves. And then Madison Hemings, who was one of the children, was finally liberated and went out west to become a farmer, wrote a superb memoir. And he's what it was like living in his father's house as a slave boy. He was called Madison because President James Madison and Dolly Madison were his godparents. And then he said, after my christening, and after Mr. Jefferson died, I had never heard of them again. They were not very good godparents, apparently. But to have pointed this out in 1973 was heresy. The roof fell in on me.
Thanks.
Dumas Malone, an absolute maker of ivory soap models, had written a six-volume life of Thomas Jefferson. And he reviewed me, and he said that my portrait of Jefferson discussing Jefferson and Sally Hemings was subversive. And he then went on, this is what I love about the court historians. He said, no gentleman in the South could ever have sexual relations with a slave. The mulattoes were created, I believe, by people from outer space who occasionally visit.
A new subject for the X-Files, yes.
And then he went on to say, as no gentleman would do this, and as Mr. Jefferson was the greatest gentleman in Virginia, he could not have done it. That is what we call in the trade a false syllogism. And upon that was based a whole mystique of Thomas Jefferson, which turned to be untrue. Now they did the DNA code last year, and I got a lot of mail, and I didn't get retractions from Dumas Malone, who was up there with the spaceships by now, but I did have an I told you so laugh.
Here's one about being right late or early but not being recognized until late. If it took 10 years for this is an audience question, obviously, since I'm reading. If it took 10 years for political historians to decide that Truman was a good president, how is a poor citizen to decide on election day?
Is he running? Why should death disenfranchise him?
In Chicago, they don't mind.
You might just keep voting for the same people year after year. Nobody would notice. I loved a remark Clinton made when Newt Gingrich had his contract on America. And the House of Representatives thought it was going to rule the country briefly, and Clinton said something which was a startling giveaway, asked about what Gingrich and they were going to do. He said, you know, the president is not irrelevant. Well, to have said that means he suspects that this could be the case. And it's well observed, because wise old wicked Richard Nixon knew a thing or two about the U.S., and he said, basically, the United States doesn't need a president domestically. Things run themselves. You need a president for foreign affairs. Everybody thought, oh, the wicked Nixon, he doesn't like the folks, and so on. Well, he's saying something very true. Domestically, the country is run entirely by corporate America. They pay for everything. They pay for this one-party system we have with two right wings, Democrat, Republican. And poor Ralph Nader is trying to do a third party when what we need is a second party.
How do you feel about Clinton now compared to, say, how you might have felt about him roughly at the time he was elected?
Well, I thought he's certainly the most intelligent president we've had in my lifetime. That goes for Roosevelt, who had far greater glamour and style and mastery of politics, but was no great thinker. He couldn't, you know, balance a checkbook. This guy actually knows about economics, you know, which the others, their eyes glaze over, as do yours and mine, but they do know. He does know much more. He made a fatal error, but for a good reason. We're the only civilized nation, wealthy nation, in the world without a national health service. Everyone else has it. This is kept from the American people. By and large, they don't know about it. And if they hear about it in Canada, they're immediately told, oh, no, no, all the doctors in Canada come down to Mr. DeBakey and Houston and have their hearts replaced. They don't know how to do it in Toronto, you know. I mean, and constant bad-mouthing of countries that have this. Well, Clinton made the correct move to try and give us something like it. What he didn't seem to understand was what Nixon knew automatically. You don't tamper with the ownership of the country. You don't do things they don't want you to do. Insurance companies, pharmaceuticals, elements of the AMA all got together to destroy first the health care plan, which they did. They paid for all of those ads. Remember Harriet and Louise, Harry? This means we can't use kindly old Dr. O'Connor who delivered our Buster Brown. I'm afraid, Louise, it does. Harry, that's communism. Well, that killed off health care, and then these three great financial entities thought, this thing is getting dangerous. They might get a health care system. What we've got to do is scare every politician in the country so he won't try to do something like that, which would be the end of our profits and insurance companies and so on. So they smeared the Clintons. I've never seen such a smear job in history, leading to the silliest impeachment that I've ever seen or anybody ever envisaged. And it worked. They destroyed their reputations, covered them with mud, and I don't think you're going to find a politician in any conceivable future who will ever mention health care again. They're just going to shore up Medicare and, you know, things like that. So he made a mistake, and I don't know why. I mean, by the time you get to be president, and he went to the Yale Law School, which is sort of the Vatican for establishment lawyers, but he seems never to have met a Mellon, you know, or a Rockefeller. He doesn't know who the rulers are. He thinks being president means you're important. Well, you have good name recognition, but you're not supposed to use it to alter domestic matters, as Richard M. Nixon would say.
So do you think it was just a mistake, a chance that he got elected if he wasn't well connected in that way?
No, he did a clever campaign. And his opposition was not too bright either. It seems to be genetic.
An audience member asks, who is your favorite historical novelist? Barring the obvious, we should say.
I don't read many historical novels because I have to read so much history. It would throw me off my stride if I really kept up with it. But I think probably the most brilliant that I ever read when I was young was The Fifth Queen by Ford Madox Ford. Mm. It's about Henry VIII and I guess it was Jane Seymour, his fifth queen. And it's just fascinating. He anticipates what the movies could do. He has long shots, close shots. He's reverse point angles. It's fascinating and superbly written and forgotten. But it is a great book.
If you're fond of saying that there are no such things as famous novelists anymore, which isn't quite true, because when I told various people I was going to do this interview, everybody had heard of you, including dancers, chemists, people online at the bank, not the kind of people who one thinks read novels, but nonetheless, your name transcends.
Well, I am the third cousin of a vice president of the United States.
But it seems to me that you've made it seem as if it's not a career a young man should go into these days. Do you think that's the case? Would you discourage somebody from becoming a novelist?
I wouldn't encourage or discourage anybody. What people will do what they're going to do. I do occasionally. Writers will complain to me, particularly in Hollywood, that they've got writer's block. I say, how wonderful. You know, it means you don't have to do it. They don't take the hint.
A couple of the things I liked tremendously in The Golden Age were the cameo appearances by Dawn Powell and Paul Bowles. That were just terrific. I mean, I assume that you only decided to put Paul in after he died. He wouldn't have been in there if he were alive, would he?
Oh, yes, he was in.
Oh, he was in anyway.
He was alive when I put him in, yeah.
You were sure he wouldn't have complained?
Well, that's his problem, not mine.
Legally complained?
Yeah. No. He does nothing scandalous in there. What I did was I needed to reproduce his kind of conversation, you know. What do you mean, put him in? That's how he would have responded to what you just said. Oh, legally? What has legally got to do with it? And he was forever taking phrases, you know, like good morning. Now, what does that mean, mm-hmm. good morning? I mean, he could drive you mad.
He seemed, I mean, I never actually met him. I only corresponded with him, but he seemed to be himself in the Golden Age. And Dawn Powell, who I never even corresponded with, I know her work only through you, really. You reintroduced her to the American public, I think. Also seemed to be a very vibrant, full figure. I had a sense I knew who she was from who she is in the novel.
She was a marvelous novelist and a very, very funny woman, which is why she was not successful. Witty women are hated in the literary world. And they must disguise, particularly in those days, they have to disguise their wit. And she couldn't stop herself. She was hilarious and very good on Hemingway, who really liked her. But I have an aria in there. Whenever I put something, words into the mouth of a person who actually lived, I work from letters, I work from diaries, I work from reported accounts. I'm not going to make up anything for Dawn Powell or Abraham Lincoln. And her diaries are just wonderful. You can find that, her aria at the end on Ernest Hemingway.
It's terrific.
How he muffed his ending when he crashed the plane in Africa with his wife Mary. And everybody thought he was lost and dead. And he got this enormous press all around the world, and very favorable. And Dawn said, oh, Ernest, just, he muffed it. The next set of, if he lives, the next set of obituaries are going to be terrible, because they've already done the good set. Now he's going to get the bad set when he really dies. This is that's a misstep for Hemingway, who was the greatest opportunist that ever hit the lit world.
What novel of hers do you recommend the most? I mean, if somebody has not read Dawn Powell, what do you think they should start
with? I think
they
could come in anywhere. But the Golden Spur, it's one of her new... She wrote New York novels and then Back Home in Ohio novels. And I like both. But The Golden Spur, The Wicked Pavilion, I think it might be the best place to start. It's sort of old New York, to which she had come from Erie... What was it? Pennsylvania, I think. And she lived in the village, and she loved that life, and she was very much the dean of New York wit. And it starts, they're tearing down the old Brevoort Hotel, where she used to hold court. And she gets more and more excited as they tear it down. She wants them to tear down more old buildings. She gets, her characters do, rather. And I think that's a good place to start.
I'll give you an audience question now. Is screenwriting, making movies rather, the future of fiction in this a-literary society?
Well, it doesn't seem to be. Certainly movies are fiction, by and large. It's hard to tell. I find that I was at Harvard lecturing a few years ago, and I had some very bright graduate students. And I was lecturing under the aegis of American civilization, a small department at Harvard, and a lot of very good students from China were in it. They were really, I mean, proper China, you know, from Peking, and they were marvelous. I found something odd. I had about 30 very bright ones, and I'd meet with them, and not one ever mentioned a book to me, unless it was something, a history book or something. No novel was mentioned, no poetry was mentioned. And whenever I wanted to, you know, keep everybody awake, I'd say, anybody here see The Doors? Well, they'd just go, oh, yes, yes, yes. And you'd get such excitement would go through this classroom. And I thought, uh-oh, that's another stake through the heart of our our glorious monster literature. I don't know what the future will be. Nobody knows. And I wouldn't begin to speculate. I suspect... The one piece of prose, kind of prose writing, that I think will last as long as the human race lasts will be the essay. Because this is the place where an individual sits down and tells you what he's thinking and his associations as he is thinking. And Montaigne starts in on Julius Caesar. And he jumps all over the place. He says what Cicero said, and then he says other things. And you suddenly are hearing a voice with Montaigne's 400 years dead, and he's talking into your ear, and there's a kinetic relationship between the voice from the past and the reader in the present. And that, to me, is the most exciting exchange of wisdom that you will ever get. He's also very funny about Julius Caesar. He says, the only thing we want to know about Caesar is how he managed to conquer Gaul and overthrow the Roman Republic. Instead, he wants us to admire him as an engineer. He's constantly talking about all these bridges that he's built, which I had to translate when I was in school. Boring, that.
It's so interesting that you brought up the essay, because I was actually going to ask you, in comparison to Susan Sontag, who now, having become a known novelist, is rejecting her essay self. She does not want to write essays anymore. She doesn't want to be thought of as an essayist. Now she only wants to be thought of as a novelist. I was going to ask you, who have been writing novels and essays all along, how you rank, if that's not too rank a word, but how you look on those relative selves, your novel writing and your essay writing self.
I think it's all part of a piece. The essay is a direct meditation aimed at a reader, and it's a one-on-one experience. The novel is equally so, but it's somewhat more intricate. And I always like something called the novel of ideas, and it's one of the reasons I was attracted to the historical novel. When I was a kid, and I read a lot of Thomas Mann, particularly his Joseph series, and I was interested in Joseph in that period, but then it suddenly occurred to me, he's playing around with lots of ideas here of the sort that Mr. Hemingway, you know, she came toward him, she was good, she was true, she was fair. He smiled. It was raining. That was a little simple-minded kind of writing for me, but... Thomas Mann would really be dealing with Hegel without ever telling you what he was doing, but you could excavate it. So I felt within history you had a certain license to do things that in a realistic modern novel you couldn't.
An audience member asks, and I'm not sure this is a correct question, but I'll let you address that. Why do Americans not write political novels?
Why don't we have a political system? We have, now it's nothing but who can collect the most money, hard or soft, to buy time on television. That's all they talk about. And occasionally they talk about reform, which could be easily done by an act of Congress, requiring networks, first forbidding anyone to buy any time, and then the networks must provide free time, nationally for national candidates, locally for local candidates. That could be done. But as far as I know, no burglar, once he climbs the ladder to the second floor, has ever kicked the ladder away. So I don't think we'll see that act of Congress. So we don't really have proper politics. We have corporate politics. They asked me about the best man. If you were doing it today, would you put it in a convention? Since the conventions are very boring now. We know in March who the candidates are, and the convention's in June, so there's no point to it. I said, well, I'd put it in the boardroom of General Electric, maybe. And they're auditioning political figures to run for president. Then you hear the directors quarreling about these different types. And I said, you could get some excitement and some surprise there.
You've had a whole other career. I almost forgot to ask you about this in the movies recently. And I remember you weren't you the villain who turned out to be responsible for everything in Gattaca? I know you were in Gattaca, but I've now forgotten the plot.
I killed my co-director, but due to some skillful editing, they forgot my scenes in which we find out I had a superb breakdown, if I may say so. But they wanted more pictures of, I don't know why.
Of Jude Law.
Of Ethan Hawke and Uma Thurman and Jude Law.
Well, Ethan Hawke I didn't see the point of, but that was the first time I ever saw Jude Law on the screen. And I thought, oh, this is somebody to watch.
Yes, I can tell from the tremor in your voice.
All right. I'll resort to an audience question after
that. Be
that
as it may.
If America had stayed out of World War II, what do you believe would have occurred worldwide in the following decades?
Well, if we'd stayed out, I think Hitler was doomed by his extraordinary genius. He invaded Russia in the winter. I think any one of us here who knows geography could have told him, you know, Dolphy, if you're going to do that, you've had it.
He was not a novel reader, I think, or a history reader.
No, he was a demented and a dope about that. He had already conquered France, and England was pretty much neutralized. And Roosevelt, however, provoked the Japanese into attacking us. I'm getting a lot of flack on that, but it's pretty well documented. And he didn't anticipate they would hit Pearl Harbor. He suspected they would probably strike at Manila and possibly taking out Douglas MacArthur. There's always a silver lining to disasters. I think Hitler was headed for, you know, the steeps of Russia. And Europe would have restored itself. Japan, Roosevelt would not have felt that he had to provoke the Japanese to the extent that he did. And we would have stayed out, and Europe would have arranged itself in its usual untidy, disagreeable way. By the way, I'm not an expatriate who ever said that. I have a house in Italy and a house in the Hollywood Hills, and you can argue I don't live in America at all, but...
Henry Adams also spent half his time in France and half in Washington.
Yes, he did. I mean, many people have two houses. I don't know how this happened. And do not belong to that 1%. Oh, Cousin Albert let the 1% have it last night.
Repeatedly. Yeah.
Yes, repeatedly. Well, you have to repeat.
I remember you said about 7 or 8 years ago in Italy that living in Italy that long had made you more American, you felt. Being outside of America had, if anything, strength, or maybe it simply made you less Italian. I might have got it wrong.
I'm not remotely Italian, except on my father's side of the family. We come from Friuli, which is the mountains north of Venice, and are not regarded as true Italians by the southerners among whom I live. But no, I live there for the simple reason that I can work. I'm not going to be politicking, and I'm not going to be distracted. I have several thousand books of American history, and I have to do a lot of reading for these books. Well, you can't do it if you are involved in politics, which I invariably am when I am in my native land. So I vacillate between the two.
An audience member question. What present-day event do you think historical novelists 100 years from now will want to write about?
Well, I can't really think. I think the coming crash of the Dow Jones and NASDAQ will be very, very suitable entertainment for the future, as all the warning signs have been up there for some time now, and I think they'll look back on this strange financial adventure that we've been going through. And I'd love to be able to read that because I'd love to know what's happening. Apparently, the laws of gravity no longer obtain if it goes on much longer. I can't give you anything from today that I think would be very interesting. The impeachment of Clinton might be interesting. Gingrich might be interesting. I was on television with him once when Lincoln came out, and he was just an unknown, chubby little congressman in Washington. And before we went on, he said, "I want you to know how much I admire your book, Lincoln." And I knew he was a conservative Republican, and I said, "Well, what do you like about it?" He said, "How it was that Lincoln was able to make himself dictator and nobody knew it, and was able to keep total control over a cabinet which was hostile to him, over a Congress which could have made a lot of trouble." And he said, "You're the first person who realizes that he was a politician and a master at it. It seems very real." And unlike, let's say, Carl Sandburg. So I thought that was a nice comment of Carl Sandburg. Edmund Wilson, our great critic, wrote, "Probably the most terrible thing that ever happened to Abraham Lincoln, other than John Wilkes Booth's bullet, was Carl Sandburg."
I was thinking about your revisionist views of all the wars, from the Civil War through the Second World War. Would you call yourself a pacifist?
No, I'm not a pacifist at all. I'm very belligerent.
Personally, but...
No, it's... Well, you should know the tradition out of which I come, the Gore family. I was brought up by my grandfather, Senator Gore, and We were the losers in the Civil War. My grandfather was born in 1870, and he was brought up under Reconstruction. And that war was the most terrible thing for those who suffered in it, and the South suffered greatly. It gives you a certain resonance, and you're not very carefree about the thought of war. And the great division politically in the country has always been between Jefferson and Hamilton. Jefferson's ideal of a sort of Arcadia, people minding their own business, farmers. Hamilton wanting manufacturers, banks, international cartels. We live in a Hamiltonian world. But we are, all of us, in that tradition, the populist tradition. The Gores founded the populist party in Mississippi. The Party of the People, it was called, hence populist. We are, every last one of us, anti-imperial. And this is just the way we're brought up and the way we regard the world. You don't mix in other people's domestic quarrels. And there was a time, in fact, even Abraham Lincoln recognized that, when the South was thinking about getting England into the war on their side, and through one of the Adams, his ambassador to England, he sent Ambassador Adams to Lord John Russell and said, if you help the South in any way, it is an act of war, and we have the means to make you suffer because we are just becoming a great military country. So this is in the bloodline, and the proof of it is the first Gore to become well-known in the country was my grandfather, who was 30 years a senator and very much against the First World War. Wilson was maneuvering us into it, and he, around 1916, my grandfather got a telegram from the Chamber of Commerce of Oklahoma City saying if he didn't vote for war, he would be defeated in the next election. He sent them a telegram saying, how many members of the Chamber of Commerce are of draft age? They defeated him in 1920, but he came back. Albert's father, most southern states tend to be, those without populist traditions, tend to be rather warlike. And Tennessee was fairly gung-ho about the Vietnam War. And Albert Sr. took the same stand that his cousin Thomas Pryor Gore had taken about the First World War, about Vietnam. And Albert Sr. lost his seat in the Senate. Whether such virtue descends, I cannot say.
When you were in your teens and 20s, were you as conscious of being a member of your family as you are now, or did you think of yourself as a complete departure? I mean, have you come back to feeling as if you're a member of your family, or have you always felt this way?
Well, you can't get rid of your family. They are always there, and their influence starts quite early. I liked Albert Jr.'s daughter came to the opening of The Best Man in New York, Corinna. And she said, you know the line I liked best in the play? It's when the old president tells the wicked senator, who has said, you know, you've got to fight fire with fire. And the president says, and the end justifies the means. He said, yes, that's what I believe. And the president says, well, I must tell you about politics and about life. There are no ends, only means. That was very smart of her. Only one critic in 40 years has ever got the point to that line, which is why I wrote the play.
So you've met Corinna but not Albert? Have you had to take a lot of evasive action not to meet Albert?
Well, I sort of look to see who's in the audience before I go into the theater. He has said that he's going to see it once he's elected.
Ah, and if he's not elected, he won't see it?
I don't know.
Do you think there's a chance he won't be elected?
I don't see how he can lose it. he's just very good at it. And he's had 8 years of being an understudy for the presidency. And he's up against somebody who is really clueless. And he was very, very good. They said, why didn't Albert go on the attack? The first person who really tears up an opponent is going to lose an election because he'll look mean. So he was very jolly and very careful, and he allowed all sorts of contradictions to, you know, just pass by, hoping the audience got it without him having to point them out. Unless something startling happens, like the price of oil going to $80, I see him as winning him.
Let me ask an audience question now. Do you have a book in progress? And if so, what is its subject, if you care to tell us?
I thought I might write something about Friuli. These are the mountains up the Alps, north of Venice, where the Vidals came from. They are not very interesting, but the countryside is. Witchcraft is still practiced, and demons are seen, and the Holy Office was forever going up there during the Middle Ages to burn people alive, you know. And it was, you know, just cheery, you know, there's a lot of fun. The citizens cast a lot of light when they set fire to them.
I was thinking as I walked here and I walked by the Ritz-Carlton and saw people out there waiting for their cars to come get them, that we live much more in a third world country than we did, I think, 20 or 30 years ago. Does that seem true to you about America? At least the big cities, the big rich cities.
Well, one of the reasons that they're falling apart is that they have very little tax base. The rich have moved out into suburbs or further. And the one subject we must not bring up, so I shall bring it up, is that in the old cities, too much property is owned by the churches and synagogues, and they are tax exempt. Wall Street belongs to the Episcopal Church, literally. Trinity Church is the most beautifully kept up church on earth, as it has revenues slightly larger than the Vatican's. Because you cannot tax religion, which is not in the First Amendment at all, they just said you can't establish one, but it was considered nice, you know, religion is an okay thing, not to tax the little white church on the corner of Main and Elm. But what about the portfolio of the mother church? These are vast, and they own all this property, and they pay practically no tax, sometimes no tax at all, which is why I think I got my best response when I was in the Senate primary by saying I would like to tax all of the religions. Particularly the TV evangelicals. Now you press your hand, now you press your hand, now you press your hand, now. Oh, and right on the screen, right on the screen. You will be saved, you will be saved. Can't you feel it? Can't you feel it? Send the check in here. We can, we're doing God's work here. We're doing God's work. Okay, it's a free country. You can say anything he wants. You can get as much money as he wants, but I want somebody from the IRS sitting beside him.
Now, I want to tell a little story to the audience before we close, and then I'll ask you one more question, which is about Gore's generosity. In 1981, I had just started the Three Penny Review. It was a tiny little magazine. It had a circulation of about 1,000 at the time. It has a huge circulation of 10,000 now, but at the time, it was small. And I wrote him a letter saying how much I liked his work. He was in Italy. I sent him a letter there and saying we were starting a new column. It would be writers answering their critics, and he seemed to me to be the perfect person to start this off. Would he do it? He was, by the way, the first and the last person to engage in this column, but he agreed to do it, and he wrote back, and he said, I will do it because I'm running for Senate in California, and I need the visibility. And I thought, not only generous, but humorous. So I guess I want to say, do you think, because that act of generosity was also an act of optimism and hope and the sense that there are things, possible things that can happen in the world that are likely possibly to go well. And your general ironic tone doesn't necessarily suggest that you feel that way. Do you think there's hope?
Well, you wouldn't write a book if you didn't think there was some hope. I mean, no, it's to write books, to write at all, is communication. What are you communicating? You're communicating your view. Why do you want to communicate it? Well, you may have seen things others missed, or you may have put together a situation in ways that people don't put together. And it makes you rather unpopular if you say what you really think. I like that quotation. I say 80% of what I think. I still hold back about 20%, yeah, particularly in this election.
Well, thank you for being with us today.
Many thanks to Gore Vidal, author of The Golden Age and innumerable other works, and Wendy Lesser, founder and editor of Three Penny Review, for joining us tonight. Thanks also to our audience here at the Fairmont Hotel, as well as those listening on radio. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California and the nation's oldest and largest public affairs forum and Stacy's Bookstore is adjourned.